Okay.
Let's get started. So, first off, my wiki's still down. My wiki is down for an interesting security-related reason. Not because it got broken into or anything like that, but because I was running Ubuntu 17.04 on my desktop and on all my personal systems. Anyone know why that's an issue? Ubuntu, I did not know, well, I kind of knew this, but I didn't quite, it never had smacked me in the face like this. So Ubuntu has two types of releases, the long-term stable releases and their more in-development releases. The in-development releases are every 6 months, the long-term stable ones are every 2 years. Long-term stable ones get updates for like 3 years in the desktop and like 5 years in the server. It's like a really long, you know, update period. The releases that come out every 6 months otherwise only have updates for about 8 months. Actually, not about, 8 months. In other words, after a new release comes out, you've got 2 months to upgrade. Otherwise, it just stops updating. So I noticed, like, for the past week, I was going, like, I'm having trouble with getting to Ubuntu servers. My system isn't able to updating and stuff. It's like, yeah, I know I need to update, but I've been behind for the past couple of months. So I've been just like, okay, let me just put that off until later. And it's not updating. And I realized, I looked up, it's like, oh, it's not being updated at all. It's like, so I have to upgrade now. So I did. And it broke my system, of course. Actually, my laptop, my desktop were fine, but my at home, but my desktop at work wouldn't boot. And then I didn't get it to boot. It was a small thing, and medium was broken. But yeah, so I'll fix that this afternoon, and it'll be up. But anyway, one of the things you should keep in the back of your mind is this constant need to update your systems really the right way to secure systems? Does this actually make sense? The short answer is no. The long answer is, what do we do instead? We'll talk about that later. So, I've opened up slots for you to submit your experiences starting a week from today. And I'm just going to have them basically every Monday. You can turn in one. So you should plan on having something done by next week. I'm going to give you a couple other experiences. I've given you, I think, at least one. Maybe two last time. But part of the wiki thing is supposed to be a list of these things. So you should be playing with these tools and trying to do these things. And I'm not expecting you to succeed, but I want you to make a genuine effort to try these things. If you do this, you'll then learn the concepts that we're going to be talking about. Otherwise, you'll do well on the assignments, the midterm, and final. If you don't, you're not going to understand anything, and you're going to have problems. So try to, it's kind of a weird structure, I know, but it's just the, hopefully, you'll see how it goes. So today, we're going to go a little beyond the system host, the single host problem, and let's bring in network and the problems that that brought up. So when initially when networking was being developed, networking was developed before this, when you really was trying to develop the ARPANET or the internet. So what's the basic structure when we say, from a developer perspective, what does the internet look like? What do you program it as mostly? I mean, it's really, kind of still a client-server. We have a server, and this thing called the internet, net, which connects these two. So you connect to that, and you connect, and you and of course, these connections are bidirectional. So if these are two boxes, When we really talk about the client server, what are we actually talking about on these two ends? Are we talking about the whole computer?
A socket.
Well, so sockets is part of it. But we're talking about a process. Right? There's some process here, and there's some process here, and those processes are messaging each other. And of course, they're messaging each other by, okay, there's a kernel underneath it, and so they send stuff to the kernel sends stuff out here, and goes through some stuff there, and then it goes over here, and goes to the kernel, then goes back up to the process. And same thing both directions, right? You have two processes communicating with each other, and the processes are communicating with each other by way of this network thing and by way of two OS kernels. Because the OS kernel provides an abstraction over the networking hardware. Now, one other reason we do this is because there's probably more than one process on each side that's talking to the network. So when data comes into a system, the main identifier for it is an IP address. Right? The IP address is how you know who the client is and how you know who the server is. But that's referring to the box. That really is the label that the kernel has. How do we know which process we're talking to?
By port.
By port. So it's so the IP address is for this, and the port identifies the process. So anytime you send a message from one system to another on the internet, that's basically what you're doing. I mean, the ports can be TCP ports, they can be UDP ports. That's just there are two different namespaces for ports based on, you know, we're saying datagrams or, you know, or you're doing socket, well, datagram sockets or connection-oriented sockets. That's just an abstraction on top of this setting datagrams or doing full, you know, data streams. What if you want to do something that's not TCP or UDP? Where does the message go? It just goes to the kernel. It's the kernel's problem. And it can choose to redirect it, but it doesn't have a notion that, okay, this there's all these processes using this. Like, oh, who's going to get ICMP messages? Okay, someone is registered to listen to them, so they get it. That's classically why things like ping need a bit of privileges, because in effect, they're basically, the kernel will give me some of the packets that are destined for you, and I'll take them. Because there's no port. There's nothing to identify which process gets it. So in this picture, what's the first basic level of security we might want?
It'd be good to know who you're actually communicating with.
Well, more just who are you willing to talk with? So you think that there's making sure that who you're talking to is who you think you are talking with. Now, if we're talking about identification on the basis of IP addresses and ports, this stuff is very easy to spoof in the classic internet protocols. We will talk later about how we've been trying to improve that, but basic protocol, that's very easy to fool. Because again, the protocols were designed to work. And working was like, yay, it works! Not adding on a bunch of cryptography, which would break everything periodically and really slow things down, especially for the hardware they had at the time. But beyond that kind of authentication, is this really the right IP address or something? But let's just take this as a very simple thing. It's like, do I want to talk to all computers in the world? No, probably not. Now, the notion of having a web server that really talks potentially to anyone is a somewhat of a later development in the history of the internet, because the web was a much more, you could say, promiscuous kind of protocol than older ones. what you really wanted with older ones, the most...
Yeah, the most willing to connect to any systems were classically things like email. So, you know, the email servers would have to talk to other email servers. And, but really, originally, it was really a server would talk to any client. You would just sit there and listen and say, talk to me, and it'll do something. And if you gave it some malformed input, it might go, I'll go away. I mean, the most classic example of this is something like finger. You don't know what the finger command is? It's kind of an odd command.
You used to be able to look up information about like where someone works and what they do, what their email address is, what their IP site is, but that was wrong.
Yeah. So you could, this was before there was Google, there was Finger. But do you know how this worked? This was just the Finger daemon. It wasn't necessarily even a full daemon. It was a process that would be started up by a more general daemon called INetD, because why have like 50 programs running in parallel when you just have one that would start the other program that's needed? But so, but essentially there would be this finger daemon that would be listening for finger requests. And the finger requests would essentially be a username. So what you would do is you would say finger. This won't work, but I'm sure I can flip a configuration bit on, you know, if you know, thing somewhere and probably get the finger protocol to work, although the SCS firewall would block it. We'll talk about that. But so you do this, you'd run this command on your command line, and it would go to this machine, would translate this host name into an IP address. Well, that of course is something we'll talk about later as well. So many things. But so I connect to this machine, and it would say, hey, give me the information on Soma. It would say, okay. And in fact, can I, does it work locally? I don't know if it does. It might. I'm just now curious. Oh. Nope, not installed. Okay. I was just curious if it was installed, but. So yeah, no, it doesn't work. But yeah, so this what this would then do is it would output, okay, the username and their, it would output kind of things when you look at going like, this is kind of random. So it said the username, their real name, their office number, their phone number, their shell. I think it would even output your shell. Basically, it would output the stuff that's commonly stored in your password file. It'd basically dump all those things out. And then it would output your plan file. So you'd have a dot plan in your home directory, and it would just spew this out for finger. And some people, what was really great, some people made the plan file like actually be a socket, so they'd have a program run, and it would generate random plans or something. Like you might be able to finger someone, it would just give you a fortune of the day. Or just something random, or just sort of make up. But in principle, the idea of the plan was saying like, okay, you're working, right? Because computers are for work. And so this says what I'm working on right now, if you're curious. And that's just a way to kind of put a little billboard up. You know, like status updates for social media? There was finger. That's how you find out what people were up to. I mean, yes?
Is it deprecated now?
Oh, God, yes.
The so most systems, you go back to the late 80s or so, would allow finger requests from anywhere. And in fact, the Morris worm, one of the ways it's propagated was by exploiting a vulnerability in the finger daemons. That you give them, I think, a really big username or something, and cause a buffer overflow and take it over. But basically, you give it bad input, and it would let you take over the thing. And oftentimes, the finger daemon was running with root privileges. So yeah, once you had control of the finger daemon, you could do whatever you want to the system. Needless to say, this is a bad idea. So for a while, nowadays, these kind of services, that, I mean, there were a lot of these little services that were just sort of anyone could access. There was an even better one called Chargen. You know what this is?
Some sort of character generation?
Character generator. That's exactly what it is. In other words, you want to do a bandwidth test? Just connect to the Chargen service, and it'll just start flooding you with characters. It's like, oh yeah, you want, you know, because hey, you know, it's the old internet. You sometimes want to know if things are working. Just send me data. Let's see if packets drop. So yeah, Chargen service just starts doing that. I mean, what could go wrong with making a service that just spews out bits?
Where does it get its bits from?
I think it's not even anything particularly random, but I think it's random bits. I forget what the charges are, but like, they're not secure random bits. Just calling CRAND or something. I had to look exactly. I just remember that being just a lot of bits, but titled the RFC for what charge it. But this was a network service. There's all kinds of these. You go to the old internet protocols, there's all kinds of these random little services for doing things. And you might go, okay, how do I know which service I can access? How do I do that? I mean, it's not like I'm going to a web page and different hosts have these things and I have a query box. And like, it's just a program listening on the network by some weirdo protocol. Well, you could still in principle do this now, but basically no one does this. There's this thing called, now, I'm not sure if you, originally this was just John Postel, I think. Internet Assigned Names Authority or Number Authority, but I think it's INA. So if someone wants to look it up, they can check it on that. But basically there was a thing where you'd say, I want this port number. Nowadays, when we get port numbers for clients and so client port numbers have always been ephemeral. You just sort of make up a number. You basically ask, say, I'm going to connect, and the kernel says, okay, you get this number. On the server side, the number would often be a well-known number. This is where the whole thing of below 1024, you have numbers that you have to require privileges to bind those ports. That's because the numbers were supposed to have meaning. Nowadays, things like SSH, port 22. Email, classic email, port 25. Web servers, port 80 and port 443. Notice these are all less than 1024. Though there's organization that would actually say, okay, yeah, you got that number. So how would you connect to these? These all had port numbers associated with them. You connect to this port number, you'll get this service. Now, as the internet evolved, initially there'll be all these computers running all these random services. You know, Windows, when they decided to get on the internet, they added their own little things. Of course, they didn't quite follow the port number thing. We'll talk about where that went later. But you offer these services, port numbers. Some of these things, no one should be connecting these, or maybe you might be limited. But you're going to say, you know, the only people who should be accessing Finger should be people inside of our organization. So if they're coming from an IP address that corresponds inside our organization, let them Finger away. If they're outside, block them. So this story is where we eventually get to firewalls. But that's not where we started. This is where I want to bring up my computer and see if I can start showing you some stuff. Did I just turn on the light?
Mm-hmm. standard.
Okay, it's coming up in a second here. Of course, that's wrong. So, as a result of me upgrading, I have a completely new desktop, which I've been trying to... Does anyone know why there's a completely new desktop? Anyone been following this? Okay, so...
Switch back to GNOME.
Hmm?
Switch back to GNOME.
Ubuntu switched back to GNOME. So, for a long time, the Ubuntu folks, Mark Shuttleworth, kind of said, you know, this whole... You know, all these desktops these other folks create, they're just ugly. Ugly as sin, and they have horrible usability, so we're going to build our own. So they built Unity, which honestly I kind of liked. I did kind of like it. It had certain things, because it brought me back to the old Next Step days. That's a diversion. I'll show you later. But Next Step was pretty cool. So, actually, I do want this, so I want to show you something first. Oops. So now, observe here. What am I connecting to? I'm connecting to localhost :631. There's a web server running on my box and on basically every Linux and Mac box that has a reasonable desktop environment. There's a web server running on port 631. Try to local 631 on your Mac, you'll find this too. CUP stands for Common Unix Printing System. This is your print daemon. You want to control the jobs that are running here. You want to configure the printers and stuff. I mean, there'll be other utilities for doing this, but the native interface for the printing system is a web interface. You can cancel jobs by this thing. You know, you can actually submit print jobs by this. Do I want the world messing with my print server on my local box? No, that would be bad, but it's there. So you might ask, well, how is this restricted? It's a web server, right? And so it's like talking to the world, right? Well, fortunately not, at least on any sanely configured system. And the way we know this So, if you look here, notice these lines. Listen localhost :631. So only listen on localhost. You know, localhost on any system that runs at internet protocols, there's multiple devices connected to the internet. There's always a loopback device. The loopback device is 127.0.0.1, and that lets you talk to the computer itself. You're always talking to yourself when you're talking to that thing. So you know that if you're talking to that device, you're not leaving and going to the internet proper. So here it's saying, okay, listen to stuff on localhost, and also listen to this socket. So a program, instead of them trying to internet protocol, will open the socket. So actually, while it is a web server, my web browser worked with it fine, it is not generally accessible. So I'm saying, if you want to restrict who you talk to on the internet, the natural thing is where is the policy implemented? This is the thing you have to always ask when you're talking about any sort of security mechanism. Is first off, you say, okay, this is the rule, but then who enforces the rule? And in this case, who enforces the rule is the CUPS daemon itself. It's choosing not to listen. It's doing very basic access control, saying, I will not talk to the world, I will just talk to my own machine. If you want to make a printer, you know, CUPS, listen on your local area network, it's as simple as you just change this. You add a line for your network, or for the entire world, 0.0.0.0. Yep.
So if you're on a router, you put like 192.168.1, and then it can let the world connect.
No, so it's doing IP address restriction. So it is doing restriction on IP address or subnets or whatever. So it's.
So you'd have to put your global IP? Like, how would you make
No. What you can do is you can view your subnet. So, like, let's say your home network, all the machines have 192.168.0.something. So I forget exactly how you specify the pattern. But you can specify that pattern here. I think it's like you specify 192.168.0.0/netmask. I think you might say 255.255.0. So, but you specify the network, the pattern you want here for the listen thing, and it would only listen for those. And anyone outside of that would ignore. Now, what if someone spoofed it? Well, they can't tell. This is how your restrictions for actually authenticating things. But so if you want to open things up to really take packets from the outside world, since those can be forged, you could be fooled. If you're only saying, I just want to talk to things on my local box, well, you can basically depend on your kernel to say, that's all we're talking to. So this is a relatively secure configuration. The moment you open up to a network, not so much. And then I think CUPS has some various mechanisms for allowing authentication. I haven't looked into that. The point here being, though, is CUPS is making the decision about who it talks to. The enforcement is with it itself. And this is actually how web servers are normally configured. They're configured to just talk to anyone in the world. But you can configure web servers, of course, to listen to only certain machines. Like, for example, the OpenStack portal. That's IP address restricted. So it only talks to IP addresses on the campus network. It's not an absolute security requirement at all, but keeps a riffraff out. So what's the problem with doing things this way? As a strategy for security.
Things you said.
It's a recipe for insanity. Because every program will have its own configuration file with its own configuration file syntax and its own way of expressing rules for what it does, what it allows access to, and what it doesn't allow access to. So if you start doing this on a program-by-program basis, it can get very painful very fast. And how do you know you configure it right? Well, what's the language for Apache versus CUPS? It's similar, but they're completely different configuration files. So if you're a system administrator trying to go, okay, I want to lock down my box, this is painful. How do I lock down all services? I mean, I had to go and study each of them and see exactly how to restrict it. That's pretty hopeless. But it's there. Because, why is it there? Because you can. And because application developers, might as well reinvent the wheel, right? or just, have their own way of saying things. And, sometimes you all want to bind to certain interfaces or whatever. But if you want the application to enforce restrictions on who it talks to on the network, wouldn't it be nice to have some uniform way of specifying policy? Maybe even a combined source, a unified file for putting all the rules in. Anyone know this does exist? Anyone know what it is?
UFW?
UFW? I don't know if I know that.
Uncomplicated firewall or something?
Yes.
So I assume it's based on like IP table and things?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what's the key difference? So when we talk about classic firewalls enforce restrictions outside of the application. It's not inside the application. It's not the application saying who I'll talk to. It's typically at the kernel level. It's saying the kernel is going to have rules for saying who can talk and who can't. That's the next stage we'll talk about, and we'll talk about the relative advantages of it. But let's say I just want to do it in user space. I just want the application to be able to restrict it. We're going to assume the application exists, but we just want a nice uniform way of doing it. So what's the general implementation strategy if you want to do something like this? Make a library, right? You have a library that you can link against, and that library implements your common access control mechanism. So the mechanism for doing this that is actually still quite widely implemented, although not so much used, is something called TCP wrappers. And it's called libwrap, is kind of the thing. So like, I think if I, okay, so these are all the libraries SSHD includes, and you'll notice one of them it links against is libwrap. So libwrap is for TCP wrappers. Yeah. So the TCPD, let's see, where is that? That's what, yep. Anyone know who this guy is? Probably not. This guy, he's done a lot of good stuff for security. He used to be at IBM. I guess now he's an academic. But Wietze, he's probably best known for PostFix, the email server. He wrote that. But before he wrote PostFix, he wrote TCP wrappers. So the idea of TCP wrappers, you link against this, you get a common policy file. And the files you get are things like, and there's a few ways of doing it. I always use it this way, is you have a host.deny. So like I have configured host.deny on my box. And so what this has is just my policy is really simple. All:all. So the default rule is if you're using TCP wrappers, don't talk to the network. Just go away. But I probably want to allow someone in, right? So the only thing I allow is SSH. But my normal configuration for SSH is I allow it from locally. So this is not a firewall. Not in the classic sense, because the enforcement point is within the process. And in fact, what's happened is every socket connection that these programs do goes through libwrap. It's literally a wrapper around it. So instead of calling the basic socket mechanism, you call libwrap's version of socket connect or whatever, and that makes an access control decision based upon the contents of files like this. And it says, okay, is this allowed or not? So enforcement is distributed in every program that links against libwrap, but the policy files are unified rather than having a per application policy file. So.
So does this CUPS software go through libwrap?
I'm not sure. There's a way to check. I don't think it does. Yeah. Let's see. Nope. Which, again, is one of the problems. So what's the advantage of doing user space? The program developer can basically include this. They know that there's support for it. If someone decides to use it, then it'll support the configuration files. The problem is is that only programs that actually incorporate it will use it. Yeah. There are ways to take it, take an existing program and run it through TCP wrappers, but it's kind of a pain. So really, TCP wrappers came about before there was widespread firewall support. Or it was, well, particularly before there was widespread host-based firewall support. And so now we get to, okay, firewalls. So we throw around this term of a firewall. Yeah, a firewall, basically, again, the metaphor is kind of bad. Because the metaphor is like, okay, it's something that stops a fire from spreading. Actually, no. They don't really stop much of anything from spreading. Well, they maybe stop the fire that's outside your organization from getting in, kind of. I don't know. But it's firewalls are a kind of network access control. A host-based, so there's, you either have ones for hosts or for networks. A host-based firewall operates right there. When the packets come in and out of the host, it puts restrictions on it. A network firewall will be like another box here that is restricting the packets that are going to this machine or other machines. So you can see that the reason to use different kinds of firewalls is all about who is going to enforce the rules. So if you're maintaining the network for an organization, it's kind of nice to just have one place where you implement rules. Because then you just put it there, and then all the boxes, the hundreds, thousands of boxes behind the firewall, are then all protected.
Wouldn't that cause problems if someone was on the network anyways? Like, even if you had like a network firewall and then you have someone connect who's trying to attack stuff, can you not put too much trust?
Crunchy on the outside, chewy on the inside. That's the classic metaphor for the network firewalls. Because, yeah, once you get past this, you're home free if all the other systems, you know, don't have restrictions. So there's kind of one idea now. You also have this, and you have firewalls in all the hosts. The new trend in organizations now is to forget about this entirely. Get rid of these network firewalls. Because it turns out these things just cause problems in modern networks and give you a false sense of security. Let's talk a little bit about the mechanism first before we talk about the security problems. Because for security, you have to understand what it is before you can really decide what sort of security it's buying you or not. So we're saying it's just a thing of rules here to block things at the host or block at the network. If it's on a host, where does the firewall have to have access? Can it be in user space? No. Not the enforcement part. You can have things to update the rules and other things. You can have like nice little GUIs and things to help manipulate the rules and stuff. But at the end of the day, the actual rules have to be loaded into the kernel, or at least loaded into whatever part of the system controls your network stack. Because you're making policies about all network packets. And if you don't have that kind of access, you're left with something like TCP wrappers, which some applications use and some applications don't, and so programs can get around it. The only way you can make sure programs can't get around it is you have to stick it in the kernel. If you don't stick it in the kernel, you stick it in a box here, you just have to make sure that this box, maybe here it might run in user space or something, but these things have to be, they're kind of dedicated appliances often. Although that really isn't saying that much in terms of what the actual software is. Often they might be running Linux, they might not. But
the topology of the network has to be such that all traffic has to go through these boxes. And thus, these boxes can become bottlenecks. You have to make sure they can run at line speed. However fast the network is, then you say, oh, this firewall is protecting 1,000 computers. That means it has to see the traffic going to 1,000 computers. So, you know, that places severe limitations on its performance characteristics. I mean, it's one thing if you say, okay, this is a network switch or something. Well, a network switch, or what, you say, oh, we're going to have multiple pipes. And you're gonna, we're going to, you know, separate off so people will connect to the internet in different ways. But now you say, oh, no, but I need it all to go through one firewall. So I can make sure here, you know, now that you get the things like distributed firewalls, and everyone having the rules, you're going to propagate it there. You can see how that might get kind of messy. But again, a firewall blocks, restricts the ability to exploit a particular bug because you cannot get, say, to the finger demon. But the finger demon is potentially still there if you can just get around the firewall. So that's why I've always thought firewalls were a crutch. If you're having to rely on firewalls to secure your organization, it means you aren't doing the real work. What you really want to do is do things like turn this off. Don't run any unneeded services. The only services that should be running are ones that can safely talk to the entire internet, and then you have to lock them down. Anything that's not able to talk to the entire internet or able to make its own, you know, decisions of what to do isn't safe to talk on the network, period. And so turn it off.
In that case, would you recommend that businesses that are running Unix-based systems, they should be running systems where they built it from the bottom to top, like Arch Linux versus Ubuntu or CentOS?
Any modern Unix-like system, whether it's FreeBSD, you know, Vanda BSDs or any of the Linuxes and stuff, they don't run many services out of the box that are available to the general network. They are mostly quite locked down. The only way you open up a service is by installing a particular application. And when you install that application, it can be like, okay, no, file sharing is not enabled by default. If you install the file sharing, you know, thing, then maybe we'll turn it, but you have to make that conscious decision to enable that service. Out of the box, it won't have that. This is a contrast to more monolithic systems like Windows, where all that functionality will be there. And sometimes, it used to be it was turned on and just disabled by like the Windows firewall. A Unix box just wouldn't even have the code there. Because you just, why include it? Or at least make sure it's tuned to only talk to localhost. So, what's the firewall? If you have systems properly configured this way, what's the firewall buying you? Well, what the firewall's really buying you is protection against the bozos who mess with their computers and turn things on they shouldn't. But if you have that problem, you have bigger worries. If that's going to really cause problems.
Why would Windows do that if it's such a problem to just dump
everything? Windows now is pretty locked down. That's why Windows now says enable Windows firewall, and it's enabled out of the box and locks and prevents a lot of things. But then, and if you just use it that way, it'll work okay. But you start doing things like remote desktop or something, then all of a sudden you start having to blow holes open in that firewall, which, and restricting where those things access can be kind of tricky. So, and that, as long as you say, don't do anything, you're in good shape. It's when you start saying, oh, I actually need to communicate here. And if you're just doing outbound connections, you're mostly okay because the program listening in is only listening while you're using it. But the moment you have to wait for incoming connections, it's kind of tricky. This is, at the end of the day, why running services in your home is not necessarily the best strategy. If you have a computer, if you have a computer running on a network that's listening for connections from anyone in the world, that computer needs to be monitored.
Someone has to take care of it to make sure bad things don't happen to it. How much attention do we have for those boxes? And this is why we outsource a lot of stuff. Say, let someone else take care of the monitoring. I don't want to deal. And it's not a question of power. I mean, you can make a pretty darn powerful machine out of, I mean, as far as a network server out of a Raspberry Pi. I mean, the amount of horsepower in one of those things is much more than the old web servers and other internet network servers. But the services that are used is a little, it goes deep. Does anyone know how time is synchronized across computers? Like, when you say to your Windows box, keep time synchronized with the internet. Does anyone know what's happening?
There's like a certain institution that keeps track of time that connects to it.
Well, yes, that's part of it. Yeah, someone's got time, but
it has to measure like the delays in the network to account for that.
So there is a network time protocol daemon. There is a service that runs on your system, which listens for updates about the clock. Now you might say, okay, well, what's the big deal? It just sets the clock. Oh no, this is a fancy piece of software because it models your clock of your actual computer and tries to figure out how much it drifts from an external time source or multiple time sources. And so it can then figure out how to periodically adjust it so your clock is always in sync. It's not that, oh, we'll go for 2 days and, oh yeah, you're off by 5 seconds. Oh, let me add on 5 seconds. No, no, it wants to add on things at like the millisecond level, so your time is always really precisely synchronized with the external one, the external clock. So everyone has the same time all the time. It doesn't skew. This is actually very useful and very important for a number of protocols, but how do you do that? I mean, that means you gotta have ongoing network communication with remote services that tell you the time. There's protections in MTP with saying like, well, if I get a really big time delta, I'm not just gonna change my clock. Because some things, you can actually have security vulnerabilities if your time changes too much because some things were, oh, this was used at this time, it was valid for this many hours and now it's no longer valid. You change the clock, now all of a sudden it becomes valid. But yeah, it's communicating constantly on the network at a low level, adjusting your clock. Does that require some privileged operations? Yeah. It's listening to other random machines. I mean, it's, when you dig around in your what your computer's actually doing, there's a number of things like this. And for a long time, the code base of this was really neglected. People weren't really locked it down. Then all of a sudden, people, oh, you know there's this vulnerability. Oh, you know there's this vulnerability. Oh, yeah, there's this problem. It's getting a little more love now. But it's still a potential vector for the way to attack systems. To the point that, I have to say, in SCS, Peter, is, you know, the system in there, is very paranoid. And it's, I mean, it's annoying at times, but it actually is pretty reasonable. Because he does things like, you can't talk to outside NTP servers. So, out of the box, most Linux boxes, as well as Windows boxes, want to talk to NTP servers. If you try doing that on the SCS network, you'll get blocked. Even though it's an outgoing connection, it's still going to be blocked because you're talking to these random servers. If you want to synchronize time, you need to talk to Peter's time servers. And they talk to a couple other ones in the world. So I have to have a custom NTP configuration on my on homeostasis so that it keeps accurate time. If I just take the outer, I mean, by default, there's a pool of NTP servers around the world that, you know, Ubuntu and Debian boxes just talk to, like pool.debian.org. They'll just connect to one of these things. And there's some process by which your box can get added to the pool. So that works for most of the time, but it won't work on the SCS network. So firewalls are useful for like implementing those kind of policies of saying, you know, I know everyone does this. No, you're not doing it on my network.
we're going to lock that down. Implement your paranoia in a domain where you don't have control over all the boxes on people's desks. Does anyone know the technology that really makes network firewalls mostly useless from a security perspective? There's one technology that corporate networks love.
VPNs?
VPNs. Virtual private network. What is a VPN? Say or no?
Like an intermediary server that you connect to security, which tries to be on.
So you have your corporate network. Corporate firewall. Really, when we say you have a corporate network, really, that's what it means. You've got some sort of firewall here that blocks connections to the corporate network, whatever machines are back here. A VPN takes my little box over here and goes around the firewall and puts you on the corporate network.
Doesn't go around the firewall, but it's through.
Yeah, right. It's really not going around, but it's might as well, it's going through it. But what's happening is it's being tunneled through it. The idea is that there's a VPN server behind this, often, or maybe it's integrated into the firewall. You connect to the VPN server, and then your computer gets an IP address that's inside the corporate network. Now, the reason why it's private is because this flow of packets is typically encrypted and authenticated. So whatever you connect to things, so now if you want to talk to a web server, if you're now connected to a VPN here, and you want to talk to Google here, normally you would go through the regular network and you go here, but no. If you're connected to a VPN, your packets will first go to the corporate network, and then we'll go from there, go out to Google. And the idea is then, when you try connecting to Google, you'll actually have to go through the corporate network firewall and are subject to the restrictive policies there. A lot of corporate networks don't allow you to just browse the web. Your computer cannot directly connect to random web servers. What you instead have to connect to is what's known as a proxy. A computer that will then there connect to the web for you. Now, why do you want to go through a proxy? Because it will implement policy, such as saying you can't visit all the web. You can't go there. Like, you might even have things where you're in one a corporation will say you cannot visit the web pages of a competitor. That might be restricted. It's like, why? Well, maybe if you start looking at the competitor's certain web page and they see, oh yeah, you're coming from here, they might get some intelligence realizing that maybe you're researching a product to compete with it. It leaks information. So there's lots of reasons you might want to restrict where you browse the web other than just pure security reasons. But that's kind of the, okay, now you're subject to our policy thing. But there's a little problem here. What's the problem?
People get VPNs to access the sites they're not allowed to.
I'm sitting here.
Okay.
What can I do if I just want to access the regular network, the internet? I turn off the VPN. I turn off the VPN and I'm now connecting to the world. So I sit here on my laptop, I'm surfing away, I'm downloading my movies and everything. It's like, oh, I better fill out my timesheet. My timesheet's on an application that's behind the firewall. So I better fire up my VPN. Connect to your VPN. Now I'm on the corporate network. Now let me fill out my timesheet. And then I'll disconnect. I'll go back to downloading my movies. Little problem now? My machine has been infected by all kinds of crap. And now that's on the corporate network.
Don't they have like policies where you can't use your own computer? It's like you only can use our computer. Generally, they wouldn't put in blockers preventing you from doing that.
Oh, there's all kinds of policies, and there's all kinds of ways people work around the policies. But just the simple thing of, even if you take a fully locked down machine, you're traveling around the world with it, connecting to who knows where, you know.
Leave it in your hotel room.
Or just leave it in your hotel room and have someone, you know, modify the hardware, you know. That's really a problem for a lot of, you know, corporations concerned with, you know, industrial espionage.
Yeah.
That machine now has been put onto your network thanks to the VPN. It's like, how can you trust it?
Although that is becoming a bit less of a problem because people have their own personal...
BYOD.
And people are doing that a lot more. So they'll have external wireless and such around it.
Yeah, that's why they're moving away from having corporate firewalls. I mean, you might still have a corporate firewall, but it's a legacy thing and you don't actually expect it to really protect you. Any system, and we're going back to a world where we realize every system, if you have services on it, the services have to be protected. But that's why I hate VPN. It's this classic thing. Oh, we made the security mechanism. Oh, we need to get around it. So here, let's get around it in a secure way. I mean, there are, you might say, well, how could I lock this down? How could I make it so that this VPN isn't completely a joke? Any idea?
I can tell you how the US military does it. Mm-hmm. You have a special USB key. You plug that into your computer, you boot to that USB key, and that's the only thing that can connect to their unclassified network via the VPN.
Oh, you boot the entire computer from the USB stick?
Yeah.
Okay, so that protects against some attacks. A lot of attacks, actually, because that's now a trusted software stack running on your system, assuming your hardware hasn't been too compromised. You should be in pretty good shape. Another thing people do, that's really extreme, but not necessarily unjustified, is to run a health check. Before you can connect to the VPN, it's gonna say, well, first, you know, run the software that's going to scan your system, see if you have any malware running on it, see if you have any known bad things going on, make sure your configuration's up to date, you're fully patched. Only then can you connect to the network. I'm not saying there aren't ways to do it. I'm just saying that. Notice where the security then comes, though, from is not the fact that you're restricting the connection. It's the fact that you're vetting the computer before it's connected to your network. That's the security part. And then I'll let you onto it. But it's like, if you're letting connections from the outside world, why not just lock down the service? Isn't that the point of attack? And in fact, most of the things that you're... How many of these internal enterprise services are now being outsourced to the cloud? Any organization that uses Salesforce, for example, or Slack or something, that's all going to a completely different network. So what's the point of discussing all this? What am I really trying to get at here is networks were designed initially to connect computers. And the connecting was like, yay, you can connect computers. And it took a little bit of time for people to go like, ooh, this is not such a good idea. This is potentially very dangerous. Well, really what it is the people who were doing the networking, the people who were doing the security, were different people. And the security people kind of got involved and said, oh my God, that networking's horrible. Turn it off. And they got their way for a while, and then eventually it's like, no, you gotta connect your computers. Sorry, we have work to do. And then they started saying, well, let's lock, that's when they started implementing things like, oh, let's lock this down because people are buying too many things. Let's do a firewall, that's a quick band-aid fix. And then people thought, oh, that's the real way to solve things. It's like, no, that's a stopgap. That lasted for like 20 years.
as a way to lock down networks. And that's what often happens with security, is the mechanisms are always late to the party, and they stick around for much longer than they're actually useful. Because the notion that you keep that mechanism, it's like, what do you mean I don't use that? That keeps me safe. Don't I need that? And they go, no, you don't. And in fact, it's causing more problems. I have to give it up. And people get worried. I mean, it's this natural safety thing. People, it's not a security precaution, it's a ritual. It's security theater. It's the checklist. This is how you secure things. And that's what's happening with, and that's what happened with networks. But back down to actual mechanism, you do need ways to restrict access for programs. And some programs, you still need them, but you don't need them talking to the whole network. You can restrict it on an application basis, in a application-specific way, or in a more generalized way. And then you can then less effectively, but sometimes importantly, you can start restricting it outside of an individual box on the network. Last piece of this puzzle. What's the trend with modern systems on how to subdivide all this? I've kind of messed up things in talking about this way, because that's actually not how we divide up the world anymore. Boxes with processes talking to networks. How do we divide up the world nowadays?
Virtual machines
and containers. So, in the context of networking, a virtual machine actually isn't that different. It just means that you have one box that has a bunch of little boxes inside of it. So since you have a bunch of little boxes on one big box, what can you do? You have a virtual network inside of the box, connecting all these things together, also connecting it to the main host system. So you can implement per process inside of each virtual machine restrictions. You can implement it on the kernel in each of these little boxes. Or you can implement something at the network level, which is really for this entire host. That's a lot of enforcement points. But that isn't even the modern view. That's the almost modern view. You have lots of virtual machines, and you do that. What's the real modern view? You know?
Are you talking about like Dockers and stuff like that?
Containers.
Yeah.
The real modern view is a container. And a container is not this. A container really is, you have a box, you have a kernel, and you have these little, little restricted things. These are your containers, but they all run on top of one kernel. So basically a bunch of processes grouped together, and the groupings are supposed to be separated from each other. Okay. What does the network look like? This is an ongoing problem. This has not been completely solved. How do you restrict this sort of networking? Is the networking control in the, you can do it in the process. That's kind of how it's done a lot of times now. You can do it in the kernel here, but you can do it in the container? The container is really, to the kernel, just a group of processes with a common policy. How do you what does it mean to restrict their access? Really, it's kind of an application-specific firewall. I mean, it's a firewall per process group.
When you're running a server on cloud, is it run on a container on the same machine as other people?
Depends. A lot of times you get this. This is kind of more when you're Amazon, you get a virtual machine that's that virtual network, and there's firewall policy. And actually, you define, you know, you have a web panel which defines the firewall policy. You're saying what your machine can talk to. But with real microservices and with containers and stuff like that, you're really talking about this. Restricting network access to it is really implementing a policy file that will get loaded into the kernel on that box.
But it's just your box, right? It's not, you're not sharing everything.
No, it can be shared.
Okay.
And that's part of the thing that is like, well, how much isolation do you get from the container?
Right.
Container security is kind of, I think, something we'll talk about in more detail. I just kind of want to put this little placeholder in to say, we took away all our barriers, and now where do we put the enforcement, and what does it really mean? And I mean, essentially, you'd say, well, you should be able to upload a firewall in here, but that means every container needs to have its own firewall policy, or do you have a firewall policy for the whole box where you understand all the containers that are going to run on it? But now that's kind of the whole point of containers, is to have separation of concerns.
I think I've got two questions. First one, so both of those, are they something to do with hypervisors? Is that what you mean with the policy?
Yes. We'll talk more about virtual machines.
And then
consider that placeholder. We've got a lot more to talk about there. But yes.
And then my second question is like, so the first one that's like VPSs, I'm guessing, and then the second one is like when someone's just like, I want this website and it's all templated and stuff, and that's how it's all separated. Like, I don't know if you know Yola, that's how they would do it.
It's kind of. Sometimes they don't tell you exactly what the architecture is on the back end. It's kind of opaque.
Is this kind of related to the first day of class you were saying how iPhones keep the apps in slots so they don't talk to each other? Is this kind of related to that?
Yes and no. On mobile platforms, the boxes between different applications, the restrictions between them, are pretty darn solid. They're solid because the rules are very simple. Don't talk to each other. Or any ways you can talk, I mean, if you're talking about like particular iOS, they really can't talk to each other. When you get into containers in the cloud, having everyone be completely isolated defeats the purpose. You're supposed to be making these things talk to each other. You're supposed to be building these large-scale servers by all these containers talking to each other. So how do you allow them to talk to each other? That's why things get more complicated. And we're going to talk more about the mechanism and stuff like that, but I just want you to get in your head. It's like, where's the policy? Who's responsible for the policy? Who's enforcing the policy? And who defines the policy and who enforces the policy are often not the same thing, and how you distribute them is not necessarily so clear. Like, who's allowed to restrict things, you know, here? And how do you make sure that the kernel, you know, restricts that? Maybe within a container, you know. You can think of ways to do it. But You then may have the problem even inside of a container, where if you don't restrict things right, you may make it so that you have lots of open attack surface within the container that you only restrict on the outside. Where's your boundary? And I'd say that's one theme for this class is, where's your box? Where's your boundary? So how can you play with this? So what's a good experience related to this? I'd say a simple one, but I'd be okay, you know, kind of okay with doing this. Define a firewall and play with a secondary mechanism for defining the same rules. Like, try to do the same kind of restrictions on an application level, on something like TCP wrappers, on a host-based firewall, and on your network firewall. You can do this on your home system. You're running Linux now. Can you put the restriction on your router? Then can you put the restriction on your box? And then can you put the restriction somehow in the application? Like, leave everything else open to the application.
And the real hard question for this is, how do you test your rules work? That's an exercise.
Okay, I think we're out of time. All right, yep, yeah, 5 minutes. I'll stick around here for 5 minutes if people have questions. And so assignment one will be going up very shortly. I'll give you at least a week to do it. It will be about the concepts and questions we've been talking about in the class.
Yes. Oh, no, notes. God, why am I the thing about it? Everyone want to put up notes for the class? What's the written backup? So, tell me.
Yeah, I do.
I'm saying that they just